Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're done with your Oreo?
Yeah, done with my Oreo.
Okay, good.
Do you really know what happened? Really
the brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too!
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah. I mean, I...
Mystery murdery thing.
Round two. Act two. Second go round.
If you
second
have time's the been charm. Following us on social media, you will know that...
You put it on Twitter. Did you put it on the Instagram?
Yes, okay. I did.
You're a social media manager, so I rely on you, and you do a great job in times like these.
I'm trying.
In trying times
social
like
media
these.
I look at social media very differently now than I used to, and I don't like it as much as I used to.
I think that's a lot of people.
I'm just...
Yeah.
Anyway, anywho, we were having some technical difficulties last night.
Excuse us.
We couldn't play back the
it was
at
just,
all.
It was just gone.
We're like, okay, like, yay, go team. Like, and then Mario tried to, like, test it and play it back, and nothing happened. It was terrible.
This has happened to us once before, and it sucks. So we're recording this on both our phones right now.
Hey-o.
Yeah, that's because that's how techie we are. Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy, by the way.
My name is Chloe.
My name is Mario.
I didn't pause that long.
Let's get to it. I'll go first, like I did yesterday. Or you can go first. I don't care.
Excuse me?
What?
We are pretending that this is the first time we've
I'm so sorry. We're not supposed to talk about how this is the second time we're doing it the whole time.
No.
Oh, sorry, sorry. I'll go first. Just, like, it's... the first time. Okay, so my mystery for this week is a thingy, and it's a mysterious radioactive cloud. Just super, super weird. So on October 2nd of 2017, scientists at one of the so-called Ring of Five detecting stations that were...
The Ring of Five.
The Ring of Five.
It seems very, like,
Ring of Five. Yeah.
I work for the Ring of Five, and they have a ring.
I know, right? It seems very shady. They're trying to detect nuclear particles in the air, you know, in case something happens. And it was set up in, like, the mid-80s, so, like, it was in the time where, you know, shit was very much in, you know, people's consciousness still. They started out with five countries, but it's, like, 22 now. So it's, like, mostly in Europe. And what the scientists in the labs in, like, Italy and Switzerland, I think, were kind of the first ones that saw it. Was a spike in the radioactive isotope ruthenium-106. Ruthenium-106.
Oh, she's my favorite Greek goddess.
Ruthenium. She sounds so majestic. Ooh, look at her, ruthenium. And this was very unusual to get a spike in only ruthenium-106. Because, you know, they had detected things in the past, and not even, like, you know, decades before this, you know, when an accident had happened or something in a nuclear facilities. But to see ruthenium-106 by itself was very unusual.
Is ruthenium an element in the periodic table?
Yes, ruthenium is an element. It's a radioactive element in the isotope that it's in of 106, which is called a nuclide. But other isotopes of it are not radioactive.
Okay.
I don't know why. Chemistry.
I hated chemistry.
Aww.
And the only reason I got through chemistry is because I had a good teacher.
I had good chemistry teachers, too.
Chemistry gives me nightmares and chills.
Aww. Yeah.
It makes my back hurt.
I was never that very good at it, either. I took the chemistry of art and artifacts in college.
I didn't take chemistry nothing.
It was pretty good.
Anyway.
Chemistry, nothing. They detected these traces of ruthenium-106. Now, I should say that it was harmless when they were detecting it. It was, like, at such low concentrations that it didn't pose harm to anyone or the environment.
Okay, so it wasn't, like, this Europe. Thundercloud, like, raining cancer.
No. You couldn't necessarily see the cloud. And it extended over, like, the whole of Europe, essentially.
Because
it's
a molecule.
Right, because it's just these trace elements. Like,
if you had to visualize it, right. It would be a cloud.
Right. It's a cloud in sort of a loose way, you know?
Yes. It's a metaphor.
So to speak. But it's these trace particles of ruthenium-106, but enough that, you know, it causes these spikes. But, yeah, it's like, distilled over this huge area as well.
So should we be scared?
No. But some people should, but we don't know where. And that's the main kind of, like, mystery. So the early detections, like I said, from places like Switzerland and Italy and Romania were eventually confirmed by almost all the countries in Europe, except for the ones in Northern Europe. They were the only ones that didn't detect it. Mm. Russia. And there were even tiny trace amounts found as far away as Mongolia, Kuwait, and Florida in, like, tiny, tiny traces.
Oh, my God.
You know, because this stuff gets into the atmosphere and it just, you know, goes and goes and goes right around the Earth. In a massive, you know, like Chernobyl, right? Chernobyl, the particles went all around the Earth. You know, it surrounded the Earth. just like with some of the bigger, you know, nuclear weapons tests, you know, back in the day when they didn't even really understand or know what the implications of that would be, which is fucking nuts.
Did we know the implications?
No. I mean, no one really did when they first tested
Einstein
these things.
Didn't Einstein know it? He was like, guys, we shouldn't do this. That's what some people say.
I don't really know the whole history of that too much. I know some people that, you know, worked on the atom bomb for America and stuff did end up turning against it and, like, being big advocates on the other side, but I'm not sure Einstein's history per se. But anyway, but the highest levels were eventually detected in Romania. But this cloud swept across basically all of Europe from October until October 12th. So after that, they didn't really detect anything in Europe. So understandably, even though it was, like, basically not, you know, an imminent threat, the radioactive cloud did generate some freak out, right, amongst, like, people and scientists and, like,
what is this?
I'm sure you can understand, like, people seeing this, like, radioactive cloud in the newspapers, like, oh shit, like, what's going on? And their unease increased as time went by and no one admitted to having experienced, you know, any nuclear incident, right?
Okay.
That could have explained this mysterious cloud of ruthenium.
Okay.
And the first major investigative report that I heard about in my research was from a French organization, and it indicated that the ruthenium-106, and kind of confirmed this, was very purely the only nuclide that was detected. And the absence of other radioactive elements immediately told them that this release had nothing to do with either nuclear weapons or a nuclear reactor.
Okay, because that's good.
Which is obviously good, right? Because then those are, like, the
big... That means someone's making weapons, like, if it was the other way around.
Yeah, a big, like, meltdown, like Fukushima or something, you know? This is because, you know, the purity kind of tells them this because those kind of events produce a panoply of particles, right? But the cloud hanging over Europe in the early autumn of 2017 was very pure ruthenium-106. Super pure. So mystery also surrounded the ultimate geographical source of this radioactive release. Like I said, the highest concentrations were over Romania, but the shape of the cloud, the fact that it covered the whole country of Romania, essentially, when it was first detected, precluded it originating in the country of Romania. So we know that it's not from there.
You said because the highest concentrations that's were where the highest there.
Concentrations that were reported. Analyses at the time and since, and kind of, you know, weather patterns and where they were found in the different concentrations, have always kind of pointed to probably Russia. And this particular part of Russia, that's near the border with Kazakhstan.
I'm not surprised.
For so many things. Like, was it Russia? Was it?
I know.
It's very zeitgeisty.
How many of our mysteries is the answer is Russia?
I know, right? Was it like episode 2 or something
Dominate with Ramsey, Boris Nemtsov?
Anyway, the first denials from Russia came on October 9th of 2017, before the last of the detections had even occurred, from the regional authorities of Chelyabinsk and Sverdlovsk. God, I've heard it so many times. Who ruled out the possibility of a ruthenium-106 release from their area. Certainly not from their area. So this was, however, problematized when on November 21st of 2017, the Russian Federal Service for Hydrometeorology and Environmental Monitoring, official, reported that it had detected heightened levels of ruthenium-106 in the southern Urals in late September 2017. Yes. Nevertheless, on December 8th of 2017, the federal Russian authorities reiterated that they did not believe the radioactive source was in Russia, and specifically not in the Mayak nuclear recycling facility. That's the one it could not ever have come
from.
They
just, name dropped that?
Yeah. For some
reason.
That's
suspicious as hell. By the way, it is not the recycling facility.
Right.
It's not, so look away.
Yeah, it's called something else, officially, but that's what I think it is. But anyway, they suggested, trying to be helpful, of course, that the source of the ruthenium-106 may have been the release from the battery of a downed, burned-up satellite.
Oh.
Which would include radioactive ruthenium-106 in its battery as a power source. But for several reasons, it's very, very, very unlikely that that would be the case. But part of this is because detailed analysis, of the different concentrations show that whereas if it were coming from a satellite, you'd expect it to be higher concentrations at a higher altitude, right? And then as it kind of filters down, getting less concentrated. Whereas that's exactly the opposite of what we see from this cloud of ruthenium-106. The concentrations are lower at higher altitudes.
Oh, so that's how they know it's coming from the ground.
Seems to be coming from a source closer to the ground, yeah. So, and despite extensive searching and checking with multiple space agencies, it could not be established that any satellite had actually gone down during that time. So where's the satellite that supposedly caused this cloud of ruthenium-106? In January and April of 2018, there were two separate inquiries that were convened at Russia's request, and they included scientists from Germany, France, Sweden, the UK, and Russia itself.
A science meeting.
Right. A meeting of the science minds, one might say.
Really drunk after.
This is the nerdy table. But you know that when you have a group of scientists, there's the nerdy table of the nerdy table, and then there's the cool table of the nerdy table, you know. It bifurcates. I'd be at the nerdy one.
The
hydrometeorologist.
He's top bitch.
he's the cool one. And they were, of course, trying to determine what had caused this radioactive cloud and where it began. And they concluded by not so helpfully stating, that, what's coming, that not enough data was available to make a solid hypothesis.
I guess.
So that's was their conclusion, so to speak. Some of the experts and officials that were kind of quoted in my sources and that I read about their views seem to kind of throw up their hands at this point, right? Kind of essentially saying that they would have to wait for whichever country it was, you know, whichever one it might be, to fess up to who had had some kind of nuclear incident that caused this, because that has to be what it was. And others, though, kept looking into it.
Okay.
And trying to come up with more particularly what may have happened. And they think they have a pretty good idea of what exactly did actually happen. And this mostly comes from a recent study, a recently published study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences for the United States, edited by John Seinfeld. But it's like a bunch of authors. You know, it's always the way it is. Like, yeah, 50 authors.
Which is weird.
They all worked on it, so I guess they all deserve credit. They believe that they've ruled out most other possible causes. And a couple of the other ones they've ruled out are the melting of a radioactive source, like a certain dental and ophthalmic equipment uses radioactive elements.
What, like dentures and shit?
Well, I mean, think about it. You go to the dentist, right, and they take x-rays of your...
Oh, and they use that... Yeah, they always have
to create
you,
the x-rays.
They always tell you to close your eyes because it's, like, super bright.
It's radioactive. Has to be radioactive elements involved, right? When those are melted, they can cause a release of a radioactive leak, essentially, an incident.
That's going to happen.
And it's happened before.
It happen again.
It could definitely happen again. However, the 2017 incident, right, was too large, really, to be explained by this. That large scale of a melting of these devices, like, wouldn't go unnoticed. So it really couldn't have been.
Okay, I really didn't understand. I didn't really know what you meant by
that. Yeah, it just doesn't explain the scale of, you know, the cloud that we see or saw. So, also the satellite reentry hypothesis was further kind of discredited by the fact that the ruthenium-106 has a very short half-life of only 1.5 to 2 years. So if a satellite had been in orbit for more than 1.5 to 2 years, there wouldn't even be any ruthenium-106 left.
Okay.
And there wouldn't be enough to, again, explain this huge cloud of ruthenium-106. And they think they have a pretty good idea of where it did actually, like, particularly come from. So they're fairly convinced that the release was from a mishap at the aforementioned Mayak Industrial Complex. Wow. We all know and love. Apparently they've had other issues, if I recall correctly from my research. Some incidents in the past.
Oh,
I think
so this
three
is like,
in the past, shit. Maybe two or three.
Why didn't they speak up?
Yeah.
They embarrassed? So it was statistically likely for it to be them anyway, right?
Well, you know.
Is that how that works?
Well, maybe. Probably. So, yeah, there was or rather from the pattern and everything, they suggest that between the evening of September 25th and noon on September 26th, the cloud of ruthenium-106 may have originated at the Mayak facility. That seemed to be where it was coming from, just from looking where the cloud was, where on different days, and how it moved, and all that kind of stuff. And this could possibly have been that they were, you know, unintentionally, right, of course, produced this ruthenium-106 while they were creating this isotope cerium-144, which would be used for a neutrino experiment at the Gran Sasso National Laboratory in Italy, which,
a little bit of background. I don't remember.
Right.
It's not like an energy drink or a diet plan.
No.
Okay.
No, but it's funny you say that. It has energy because it is a particle.
It's not a pill.
And, it interacts very, very loosely with anything else. It's a ghost particle, essentially. There's billions and billions of them pouring through our bodies right now, and we have no idea.
Well, because it interacts. So all of us now know.
Now you're aware, and you'll have a little tickle in your head every time you think about it. Neutrinos all around. We're bathed in neutrinos. It's weird. It's a mystery, actually. Anyway, to get back to what I'm talking about, if I can find my place. So the spent nuclear fuel, which they would have been using, right, to isolate this cerium-144 to use in that experiment in Italy, also contains ruthenium-106 and could have been released from the spent fuel while they were, like, waiting to refine it or whatever.
Why were they making... What were they making?
They were making the cerium-144 radioactive isotope in order to create a, you know, a beam of particles to be used in the Gran Sasso experiment with neutrinos. That makes sense, right? Did that make sense?
It's weird that people are, like, doing stuff on a molecular scale to me. Like, that's wild.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely want to do another episode about, you know, particles and quantum physics. Well, yeah, you know, I do.
I feel like quantum physics mystery should be an extra.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, so furthermore, the researchers at the Gran Sasso National Laboratory, when they talked to the press, said that they were notified that there was an issue at the MIAC facility when they were trying to produce the cerium-144, and it was never delivered. The experiment never happened. Now, they don't know if, you know, that was what happened, that they released this ruthenium-106, and that's what went wrong, but they know something went wrong.
Oh, so we still don't even know the core, like, problem? Like,
no, we really don't. I mean, that's really one of the two central mysteries here, right? What happened and where did it happen?
Yeah.
We just know there was this cloud. We don't know what produced it, really.
Oh, that's freaky.
But they've been able to deduce that it was something like this, where there was some kind of refining process or the recycling of spent fuel. That's probably where it came from, and probably in Russia near the border with Kazakhstan.
Probably.
Allegedly. I'm not making any specific accusations. Didn't I say that on a recent episode? I feel like that's a good... So this is a very tidy story, and it's very plausible. But again, we don't know. Another possible source that I read about in my research was the Research Institute of Atomic Reactors in Dimitrovgrad, Russia, about 90 miles north of the MIAC facility.
Wow.
Apparently, there are quite a few nuclear facilities in this part of Russia.
I was like, I can't believe these places even exist.
Yeah, there's several. But unless Russia suddenly changes their tune, Putin has done that in the past, right? Oh no, we didn't go into Crimea. Oh, and then a few weeks later, it's like, yeah, we did. We went into Crimea. He's done shit like that before.
What is the psychology behind people like Vladimir Putin?
Oh my god!
Like, what goes on is
that's
in his
such
head?
A big discussion. That's a mystery. That is quite a mystery. So we'll probably never know for sure what actually did happen, unless somebody again comes forward and, you know, lets us know, the wider world. But the last statement that was sent from Rosatom, the Russian Nuclear Energy Corporation, to the Washington Post for their July 30th story, recent story, was, quote, "We maintain that there have been no reportable events at any Rosatom-operated plants or facilities," close quote.
Okay.
Nothing to see here. So we'll give Rosatom the last word on that one, and we'll see if there's any more to come in the future. So my sources were Rick Nowak at Washington Post, Jamie Ducharme at Time, Jeff Brumfield at KPBS and National NPR, Eric Mack at Forbes, Josh Davis at IFL Science, Alan Cowell at The New York Times, CBC Radio, Umair Irfan at Vox, Emily Conover at Science News, Peter Dockrill at Science Alert, and that study that I mentioned earlier, which sort of pared down title of it is Airborne Concentrations of Radioactive Ruthenium 2017.
Is that the one that got super specific, you said?
Very, very specific. And I read the beginning of it. I read the abstract. I did not read the whole thing by any means. It is super long and very technical. But yeah, it's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it was edited by John Seinfeld from Caltech.
Seinfeld.
True. No relation, I assume.
I wonder what people with the last name Seinfeld have to deal with every day.
Right. So you're funny, right? Like like Jerry? Are you related? And they all have to be like, no. Why would I be? Wouldn't I have told you?
A terrible show about white people.
Oh.
Okay. Moving on to...
Wait, were you talking about Friends?
Shut up. I mean, that's true, though. I mean, you're not that off.
I don't like Friends. It's fine.
The other reason many people still have Netflix is because of Friends. But
it's isn't it leaving?
Yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah. People are not happy. Anyway, I have a history mystery for number 82 today. it is the mystery of the miniature coffins. Ooh. Yes, yeah. Yes, and Mario. Yes, and. So our story starts with the discovery of these coffins in Scotland on the northeast slopes of what's called Arthur's Seat. So it's a volcanic hill that lies beyond Edinburgh's old town. So Edinburgh has an old town.
I think it's Edinburgh.
Is it Edinburgh?
I think so.
Shit. Edinburgh?
I thought I'd tell you this time. Sorry, we're not supposed to talk about it.
Edinburgh? Well, I don't want to say the wrong thing the whole time.
Well, we'll just address it just for a moment. We understand it may or may not be Edinburgh, but Chloe's going to say it Edinburgh.
No, I'm going to say Edinburgh.
Okay.
It sounds better.
Pick a lane.
So Edinburgh
okay, go
had an old town and a new town. And so the place itself, Old Town, is like, it's pretty shrouded in mystery. It's the possible site for Camelot, King Arthur's fable.
Oh, Lord.
And it is said to be the home of the Votadini, which are a Celtic tribe from the Iron Age, so like 400 AD, in Great Britain. So there was an article from the London Times that came out at the time that really described it best. It was written by a Charles Fort.
When did it come out?
In 1836.
Okay.
It was written by a Charles Fort, who is a writer and a researcher who specialized in, quote, anomalous phenomena.
Anomalous phenomena. It's fun to say.
It just means I look at weird things. If you've got something weird, come to me.
I'm an oddities man.
I'm a researcher, an expert.
Right. That's like how back then you could just be like a naturalist. You just like walked in nature and then suddenly you were like a scientist.
What? I don't know what a naturalist is. We're not going to talk about that.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So the London Times, July 20th, 1836, quote, that early in the morning in July 1836, some boys were searching for rabbits' burrows in the rocky formation near Edinburgh, known as Arthur's Seat. In the side of a cliff, they came upon some thin sheets of slate, which they pulled out. Little cave. 17 tiny coffins, 3 or 4 inches long. In the coffins were miniature wooden figures. They were dressed differently in both style and material. There were 2 tiers of 8 coffins each, and a third one begun with one coffin. The extraordinary datum, which has especially made mystery here, that the coffins had been deposited singly in the little cave, and at intervals of many years. In the first tier, the coffins were quite decayed, and the wrappings had moldered away. In the second tier, the effects of age had not advanced so far, and the top coffin was quite recent-looking, end quote. So, yes.
Kind of creepy.
Some boys who were running around near Arthur's Seat happened to come across these weird mystic coffins. And so there were 17, and of the 17, 8 survived today. The Scotsman, a newspaper at the time as well, they published one of the first accounts of the discovery, and they reported that, quote, a number were destroyed by the boys pelting them at each other as unmeaning and contemptible trifles. And Mario's like, God damn it.
You goddamn kids.
So yeah, there was lots of media about it. There was a good amount of buzz. But after that, they were passed down by a series of private collectors. So Robert Fraser, a jeweler put them on display in his private museum. I have a private museum.
Well, bully for you.
And he retired in 1845, and then they were auctioned off, but we don't know where there's no record of where they were auctioned off to. And they popped back up again in 1901 with a set of eight, together with their contents, were donated to the National Museum of Scotland. And that's where I got a lot of my information. The dolls are there. Yeah, you can see them. By their then owner, Christina Cooper of Dumfriesshire. In 1906, the Scotsman again published a story about the coffin. So this is kind of a weird story, but we'll take this as you
okay,
will.
Okay, yeah, because last time I didn't quite get the story.
Okay,
so
I'll try to explain
a little bit.
So it was published by the Scotsman. They were like, oh, like we were reported. Here's like a report that was given,
okay,
the possible explanation for what these coffins
are. It's just hearsay.
Yes, but it's kind of creepy. It's a good story, I think. So basically, there's this lady in Edinburgh, right? And she's telling the story of her father, who they called Mr. B. And Mr. B would often be visited by, quote, a daft man, end quote, at his business. So daft means like foolish.
Sure.
One day, the man comes in to Mr. B's shop and shows him that he had drawn a piece of paper. And on that piece of paper, he had drawn a picture of three small coffins with the dates 1837, 1838, and 1840 written underneath. Turns out a relative of Mr. B's died in 1837, a cousin of his died in 1838, and his brother then died in 1840. And after he received that little notation, the man never returned. Ooh.
Never to be seen again.
The Scotsman article, you know, they tell the story and they wonder if this mysterious man was the maker of the coffins and that maybe he was, quote, driven mad by the loss of his treasures, end quote. Or maybe it was just a coincidence, hearsay, a story. We don't know. It's a mystery. yeah, so we kind of touched on this before, but it's difficult to say with complete certainty when the coffins were made. The range that I kind of got was sometime between, like, the earliest would be 1790 and the latest would be like 1830.
Mm-hmm.
So, note that the discovery, was made by a group of boys who probably mixed them up by hurling them at each other. And it wasn't some, like, trained archaeologist, right, who's, like, examining each particle. They're difficult to study because
sure.
of that. There's a lot of factors.
Right.
Several of the surviving coffins are also in more decay than others. So, some of the figurines, the clothes that they're wearing, the grave clothes, are in a rotten state, or they're not there at all. But whether decay was the product of time or simply weather is not now possible to say. So, the more decayed coffins that were towards the bottom. So, it's possible that because they were lowered to the ground in that nook, it's possible they were maybe exposed to water damage. So that's something they had to take in as well. It wasn't until the 90s when, these two guys, Professor Samuel Menefree and Dr. Alan Simpson, who Dr. Alan Simpson is the curator of the National Museum of Scotland, and they looked at the coffins and the little figures inside them with a lot more detail. So the figures will... This is what they discovered. The figures all appear to be made by the same hand, although it is possible that the coffins were created by two different people. Some of the material and tools used, wood, iron, embellishments, I think they used those for, like, the eyes, nails, a sharp hooked knife. These tools kind of indicate the coffins could have been made by a shoemaker, which kind of makes sense because shoemakers would have had the manual skills to make coffins like this, but they would have lacked the like the special carpentry tools needed to make something at this length precise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The figures seem to form a set, all eight of them, and their upright bearing, flat feet, and swinging arms suggest that they may have been toy soldiers. Their eyes are open, making it unlikely that they're originally designed as corpses. So then that's, if that's the truth, then that makes the coffins even spookier, right?
Yeah.
And some of the figures are missing their arms, perhaps removed, so they would fit into the coffins. The fabric that they're dressed in dates from the early 1830s. And then they did this whole analysis on, like, different types of thread and how this one type of thicker thread wasn't made until 18-whatever. And so, and it has that thread, so that, right. I don't know.
No, stuff like that is great. When it's like, oh, they didn't use this pigment
manufactured until blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they didn't start using screws until this year, so it has to be from before then or something.
Right. Yeah, so that's how they knew it dated from the early 1830s. So that means they hadn't lain buried there for more than 6 years. So then the next question is, who created them and why? Why were they created and what do they represent? This is one of those mysteries that reminds me of, like, Stonehenge, because that's, like, all the questions you ask about frickin', like, Stonehenge. Mm-hmm. Like, who and why?
The Nazca lines.
Yeah. what are they for?
Yeah.
So, at first, a lot of people thought witchcraft, right? And this is also, like, prime time. Yeah. The Edinburgh Evening Post claimed that the coffins represented, quote, an ancient custom which prevailed in Saxony of burying in effigy departed friends who had died in a distant land, end quote. Another a newspaper, the Caledonian Mercury, added that, quote, we have also heard of another superstition which exists among some sailors in this country, that they enjoined their wives on parting to give them a Christian burial in an effigy if they happened to be lost at sea. But if this is the case, then why are, like, they pretty similar? Like, it's obvious they're a set, and why are all the coffins similar? You'd think they would be, if many different people were making them for their individual husband, they would look different sizes and stuff. And others looked at it as a burial to honor the fallen soldiers. There is another theory by an author and amateur historian by the name of Jeff Nisbet. He believes that he knows why they were created. So he believes that the coffins were created as a memorial to a political movement called the Radical War of 1820, and those killed supporting it. So, quick background on the Radical War. It's also known as the Scottish Insurrection of 1820. It was basically like a political movement, but it was pretty chaotic. Like, there was a series of protests and lots of strikes. So in Scotland during this time, only one out of every 250 people were eligible to vote, right? So the right to vote was a luxury of some sorts. Artisans like handloom weavers, shoemakers, blacksmiths, goldsmiths, and woodworkers demanded reform and a more representative government. So they were going on strike, pissed. In 1812, the wages were cut in half, and then a 9-week strike followed. Furthermore, the Napoleonic Wars brought on economic depression. So there was, in general, there was a lot of unrest during this time, lots of protests for better wages and better working conditions. August of 1819 was when the Peterloo Massacre took place. And that's where a cavalry charged into a crowd of 60,000 to 80,000 people.
Oh my God.
Who had gathered to demand the reform of parliamentary representation. So they were just a crowd of protesters. 18 people were killed and several hundreds were injured. So that kind of kicked off. And then that next year, 1820, was when there was all out war. So, yeah, so that was when the strikes began and it turned to violence. Many poorly paid workers and weavers from the area were arrested, and a lot of those who were arrested were exiled to Australia, and several of the ringleaders were just executed. So following the event, many of those who agreed with the movement were put to work building a path that would become known as the Radical Road, and the path is right around Arthur's Seat. Nisbet's theory is that the reason for the existence of the artifacts was, quote, to keep the flames of rebellion lit, end quote, and to basically honor those who were protesters and rebelled against their government for a better lifestyle, and honor those who had been killed. And then there's my favorite theory, and everybody's favorite theory, is the Burke and Hare murders theory. Look at my eyebrows right now. Yes, you see that?
They are vigorously moving up and down.
So these are also, they're not like a straight up mystery, but there are still a lot of questions in here. Like there are some question marks, but here's that theory. So I read a few places that mentioned the Burke and Hare coffin murder, or the Burke and Hare murders being related to the tiny coffins. There was a couple of them, and I was like, who, what? So let's get into that. In the early 19th century, Edinburgh was really popular and known for medical excellence. So there were lots of medical schools and lots of students heading over there, specifically to study anatomy. So with more and more students studying anatomy in Edinburgh, and then fewer criminals being hanged, because that's where they got the cadavers from the criminals,
right,
who were killed. The supply was no longer meeting the demand. So this is where body snatching comes along, right?
A favorite pastime of 19th century lowlifes.
Oh, yeah.
In many, many different parts
everywhere.
Of the world. Yeah.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Really creepy. Like,
yeah.
Ew.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a lot disturbing. Of work. It is disturbing and, like, completely immoral. Anyway, body snatching. So criminals started digging up bodies in churchyards, right, and selling them to anatomists anatomists for a considerable amount of money. So in comes Irish immigrants William Burke and William Hare. So the murder spree started by quote-unquote accident. One of the elderly tenants staying at Hare's Porter House died suddenly, and the tenant owed hair money. So he goes to his friend Burke and he's like, hey man, like, what should I do? This dude owes me money. And he's like, oh, like, you do sell the body? Like, hey, we could sell it. So that's what they did. And Burke and Hare sold the man's body to a doctor, Robert Knox, for use in his anatomy school in Surgeon Square. So they were paid about £7.10. And I don't know how much that is in American money, especially today's American money.
Right.
Lots of math.
So I was just wondering, like, does he just have a sign saying, like, we'll buy bodies, no questions asked, or something? Like,
no, it's they like don't, a black market.
They don't, like, look it's into where these bodies like, came
I
from.
I heard Knox will help you out. Like,
right.
Yeah.
A little fishy.
So a little over 2 months later, when Hare was concerned that a feverish tenant would prevent others from staying in his boarding house, he and Burke murdered her and sold the body again to Knox. And that's when their murder spree escalated. So, and also, most likely with the, almost positively yes, with the knowledge of their wives, right?
Oh, okay.
So they went on to kill 15 more people, yeah, and made £150, which in today's American money kind of is around $14,000. So it was like a pretty solid, right? Burke and Hare's actions were, you know, obviously caught up to them eventually. They were uncovered when one of the tenants actually discovered who would become their last victim, a woman by the name of Margaret Dougherty. And they found her body, and they were like, oh, what the fuck, and they called the police. So after examination, doctors concluded that she was likely suffocated, but it could not be proven. So the two were arrested in November of 1828. However, Hare was granted, this is kind of bullshit, right? So Hare was granted immunity if he talked. So that's exactly what he did. He straight up confessed to all 17 murders and totally threw Burke under the bus.
That's not a good deal. If you're a prosecutor, that's not a good deal.
Absolutely terrible. Come on.
You're just going to let someone go for 17 murders? I mean, come on. Come on.
Formal charges then were made against Burke and his wife, Helen McDougall, for 3 murders. They couldn't necessarily prove any more, but Hare was like, oh yeah, we killed about 17 people. Like, that's fucked up. Anyway, so the case, and this is also kind of bullshit. Not that I'm saying like, oh, poor Burke, but you know. The case against Helen McDougall, his wife, was found not proven, which in Scotland is a legal verdict where you are acquitted, but you're not necessarily innocent.
Sure.
Yeah. I think there's an American one too.
Yeah. I don't remember what it's called, but there's something like that where it's like, we have insufficient evidence to prove the case against you. But we're just deciding not to proceed. It's like, yeah, it's kind of motion not to proceed or something.
And then Burke was sentenced to be executed. So, January 28th, 1829, William Burke was hanged in front of a crowd of thousands of people. Probably, they think, as many as 25,000 people. They were like,
that's crazy.
Let's get drunk and watch Burke get hanged. Like, that was a thing.
19th century pastimes, watching people be publicly executed. Now, there are still a few countries where that happens in the world. There are still a few countries. Saudi Arabia.
Dark.
Countries like that.
That's pretty dark.
That's pretty dark.
But this was a thing. Tenants who lived alone, like, above the square in the, like, apartments with a good view of the scaffold, sold their spaces so others could watch. It's wild. It's like selling your parking space when you live next to Wrigley Field.
Right.
Yeah. Also, quite dark. February 1st, Burke's corpse was publicly dissected by Professor Monroe in the Anatomy Theater of University's Old College. So it was a big fuck you, right?
Right.
Police. Okay, so this was actually turned out to be a big event because police had to be called when a large number of students gathered. And they wanted to see this dissection. But there was only a limited amount of space, only a limited amount of tickets. So a minor riot ensued. That's always fun, right? They solved the problem after one of the university professors negotiated and was like, okay, everybody, you guys can pass through in batches of 50, but only after the dissection has ended. So, like, just really the end result. The procedure itself lasted 2 hours. It said that Monroe, and take this with a grain of salt, it said that Monroe dipped his quill pen into Burke's blood and wrote, quote, "This is written with the blood of W.M. Burke, who was hanged in Edinburgh. This blood was taken from his head," end quote. Your face.
Great.
Well, I was like, Wikipedia, where did you get this? And they had the source, a book called The Anatomy of Murders by Lisa Rosner. But they also noted that it was one of those books that, like, had the basic facts correct and the basic storyline, but it was also a little bit fluffed up. So
a kind of historical fiction, maybe, or
not enough bullshit to be called historical fiction.
Okay. Just kind of sensationalized history.
Yes, that's the word. Thank you. So, great story, right? What does that have to do with our miniature coffins? So although it's difficult to tell exactly when the dolls were made and placed in the cove in Arthur's Seat. But due to the style of clothing and wear, it said that they were made no later than 1830. And so they have that timeline, right? There were 17 dolls, 17 victims. The dolls could have been placed there after the murder spree of Burke and Hare as a memorial. So I first read that and I was like, I guess. I didn't really get it. And then the two who studied the dolls, Professor Menefree and Dr. Simpson, wrote, I think, a pretty good argument, I think.
So, persuasive.
Yeah. So, quote, that the problem with various theories is their concentration on motivation rather than on the event or events that caused the interments. The former will always be open to argument, but if the burials were event-driven by, say, the loss of a ship with 17 fatalities during the period in question, this speculation would at least be built on demonstrable fact. Stated another way, what we seek is an Edinburgh-related event or events involving 17 deaths, which occurred close to 1830 and certainly before 1836. One obvious answer springs to mind, the Westport murders by William Burke and William Hare in 1827 and 1828. So when he, like, narrowed down the possibilities like that, I was like, okay. So if you, like, switch it to motivation versus,
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, the other way. Through that lens, it becomes, like...
Versus motivation to an event.
Mm-hmm.
They also argue that because the victims were all dissected, maybe the coffins were placed there so that they could have a proper burial. And Simpson and Menefree published their findings in 1994, and they've been looked at and elaborated on since. So the Edinburgh Evening News reported in 2005 that George Dalglish, principal curator of Scottish history at the National Museum of Scotland, believes, quote, the most credible theory is that were made by someone who knew Burke and Hare, end quote. And so if it was someone close to them, perhaps they had a strong desire or motive to make amends for, you know, the crime.
Atone.
Yes. Later, and then there's another weird thing that happened. I just thought it was worth mentioning. In December 2014, the National Museum of Scotland was delivered a mysterious package that contained a replica of the tiny coffins. It was sent with a label titled 18? But in, like, Roman numerals. And it also quoted the chilling climax of Robert Louis Stevenson's short story, The Body Snatcher, which was written in 1884. And that story weaves in elements of the Burke and Hare story.
Mm.
So it's like 18, like, oh, like the 18th coffin, or here it is. And I was like, I don't really know what that means. But what if it was like, oh, like, yeah, like my great-great-grandfather made these coffins and, like, no one knows about it. And he, like, taught, like... my grandfather and my father how to do it. I don't know. I really elaborated it.
Maybe. That's pretty speculative.
That's pretty... It's a stretch.
It's a stretch.
So, yeah. That's what I've got on there. Tiny
coffins. Tiny coffins. Who knew?
Sources are a Smithsonian Magazine article by Mike Dash, Burke and Hare Murders Wikipedia page, Radical War of 1820 Wikipedia page, and there was an article on the National Museum of Scotland webpage. They have a whole, like, interactive... thing where they have facts about the exhibits and stuff, and yeah, we should take a trip to the National Museum of Scotland. It looks pretty cool.
I'd love to go to Edinburgh.
Yeah, me too. I hope it's Edinburgh.
I think Edinburgh. So. Pretty sure. The town near where I grew up was Edinburgh. Edinburgh, Texas.
Texas,
right there on the border.
Texas.
The Rio Grande Valley. Texas. So, speaking of Texas, my weird shit
in the news,
weird shit in the news, is not in Texas, but a Texas man. TSA officials find missile launcher in Texas man's luggage.
Oh, nice. My guy.
Right. Story by Vanessa Romo from NPR. So, yeah, he apparently took a little jaunt to Kuwait on his little holiday. And he thought, you know, hey, some kind of memento, you know, to remember it by, how about a missile launcher? That's a great memento. I'll take that back from Kuwait and bring it through customs and the TSA.
Oh, yeah, so, my God.
Yeah, the TSA was said no, even though it was perfectly safe, it was decommissioned, no one was actually in any harm's way or anything. He could not keep it or take it away from, and he should not have done that. That's not allowed.
Seems like a waste of everybody's time.
True. True. So that's my weird shit.
I did a lot of scrolling and didn't find a lot.
Nothing was perfect. That's fine.
It's all, we don't need kind of, it's all very clickbaity.
Like, oh, yeah.
Man arrested with a stolen vehicle to when he rode to jail or something crap like that. Anyway.
Thanks for listening,
thank
y'all.
Thank you for listening. Thank you so much.
For waiting on us.
For caring about us, more or less.
Follow our stuff, because if our episodes
Instagram,
are delayed, we tell you.
Twitter. Hit Mario us up on Patreon. Get Patreon. Some extra things. And that's what all the cool kids do.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.